Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello again, friends. Coming to you live from Vachon Island, Washington, this is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show, radiating from the beehive of creativity, civic engagement, and cultural awareness known formerly as the Voice of Vachon Jean Bosch Broadcast Studio. In the bustling and bodacious heart of our pastoral island community. That was the voice of our late founder, Brian Brown. Together we, the Brieflys, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra, less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel is abbreviated today at the big board, our instrument panel magician, Vachon Airport Commissioner, partially reformed Texan, and longest serving Briefly, Truman O'Brien. How are you doing,
Good
Truman?
Good morning. Good morning. It's very interesting. I've never heard anybody put parentheses around a word by just making a sound, and that was very good.
Makes you want to go...
It does.
Makes you want to go to law school.
That's what it makes you want to do, right?
Well, let's not get carried away, Bruce.
Yeah, let's not.
But you're right.
Historian, professor, mariner, guardian of the galaxy, our second longest serving Briefly, Bruce Hallman. How are you doing, Bruce?
Hey, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Myself, Craig Bellis, former assistant attorney general, constitutional law professor, and part-time Christmas tree salesman. And our small talk guest today is producer, mixer, mastering engineer, composer, singer-songwriter, singing voice judge, Martin Fevrier. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
It's great to see you all.
Glad to have you in here.
Thank you.
Hey, before we cover the news of the day in our usual lighthearted but passionately serious fashion, let's first check in with the Brieflys and our guest, and see what they've been up to the last week. Truman, what have you been doing?
Well, of course, it was Thanksgiving last week. So we started a new tradition. We've been going to Salish Lodge out at Snoqualmie Falls. And it's just been terrific. I just can't get over it. And here's the odd part. 3 years in a row, we got exactly the same rooms. Exactly the same. Molly had her room. We had our room. Exactly the same. We just are baffled. But anyway, they do.
Maybe it's a Truman suite.
It could be. I'm thinking that maybe now. But one of the things they do for Thanksgiving dinner is they have, of course, the turkey and dressing and all of that, if you want that. We opted for the prime rib this year, which was fabulous. But they cooked 500 turkeys.
Good Lord.
500. And they brought them out and carved. They were smaller turkeys, but they brought them out and carved them at the people's tables. And when they got finished carving it all up, they put the rest in a bag and sent it home with them. So everyone who opted for the turkey dinner got a whole turkey, which was pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah. Did you do the whole breakfast pouring honey thing?
Oh, yeah. You got to do the drop the honey from 8 feet up and all of that. That's always fun. But they've completely remodeled their dining room and bar area, and it is just spectacular. I mean, just beyond belief what they've done. And, of course, we had to run down to the Snoqualmie Casino and win a little money, both of us. Molly and I both won a little.
Were you on the slots? Or were you?
Yeah. $40 on mine and $60 on hers.
Well, that's good.
Not bad, huh?
Didn't try your hand at crapshit.
Nah, I didn't have you with me as a coach. I got to have you coaching me, man. That's the only way I can do it. So.
I was going to ask you one other question. Did Molly drive up there with you, or did she come up later?
Yeah. Well, actually, we left on time because we were driving. So you know how that is.
Bruce, how about the last week for you?
Well, Thanksgiving, of course, is always an exciting weekend for families. All the traditional sort of gatherings and dramas that go with that. Mm-hmm. Our Thanksgiving was, I've got two great Thanksgiving stories. One was about 8 or 9 years ago. We had cooked this, Pam likes to cook big turkeys, you know, so 25 plus pound turkeys. Because, you know, you're feeding 15, 18 people, that kind of stuff. And so that evening we'd put it out in a cooler out on the back porch. And the next morning, you know, going to do sort of turkey sandwiches and all that kind of stuff. I go out, and it looks like Freddy Krueger's face. It's just sort of like the raccoons had opened this cooler and gotten in and just sort of decimated this turkey. I mean, seriously.
Oh,
I mean, it was just sort of like, and what's even more funny, going back to prime rib, that next Christmas, same thing, big turkey ready to go. Pam was brining it out on the back porch. She says, go get the turkey. I go out to get the turkey. Raccoons have gotten it again.
Oh,
and this
no.
time it was in brine, so it was like they were kind of eating it, but kind of not eating it. I mean, it looked like it had just been, you know, a cougar had taken it and sort of ripped it apart. So we called my daughter, who lived in West Seattle, or lives in West Seattle, and said, the turkey's gone. What are you going to do? She said, well, let me run by Swiftway, Thriftway in West Seattle. And she went in and talked to the butcher, and he said, well, we've got this prime rib. It's on sale because they hadn't sold it. You know, this is Christmas morning. Oh. So we had prime rib, and it was great.
Fabulous.
And so that for Christmas now we do prime rib.
All
turkey
right.
on Thanksgiving, prime rib on Christmas.
Oh,
it changed
excellent.
Our whole family tradition.
You don't go to the local Chinese restaurant no. like they did in the movie.
Right. Christmas story, right?
You know, I have to tell you, one Thanksgiving, we had a similar incident when we lived in Ballard. Mm-hmm. The power went out in the middle of, you know, the turkey was about half cooked. And we thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? So I fired up the barbecue. I put that turkey on the barbecue. It was fabulous.
Right.
And
yeah.
we thought, geez, that's what we ought to do every year. Of course, we didn't, but anyway, yeah. I thought that was great.
Well, this year, the drama was we were doing Thanksgiving at my son's house in Ellisport. He's got a bigger house, and, you know, 15 people or so. So we had gotten everything ready. You know, turkey was in the oven, you know, for 3.5-4 hours or whatever it is. Got all the sides ready to go. Everything steaming hot. Pull the turkey out. It's not done. So turkey back in the oven for another hour. All these other things you're sort of juggling, trying to keep it off. It was just sort of like, well, it's typical Thanksgiving.
To be philosophical about it.
Exactly, right. But on Sunday, the Seahawks defense looked like Super Bowl champions.
They did.
They
yeah.
look
they
great.
They really did.
So, so there's hope.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating right now, out of the time, in the power rankings, you know, sort of the way they rank, 3 of the 5 top teams are from the Western mm-hmm. National Football Conference. So mm-hmm. Seahawks, Rams, and 49ers.
Yeah.
And Seahawks play both of them between now and Christmas. So it's going to be an interesting set of games.
It is, for sure. Martin, speaking of philosophers, how about your deep, last week?
Deep philosophy. Bruce, I have some questions for you. So this Seahawks team, what what kind of sport is that?
It's called the tush push.
Tush push. Is it the American carry ball game?
It is.
Okay, because
it's not real football.
We don't use
that. No, we're not allowed to use that phrase anymore because you've stolen it for a game where you rarely kick the ball.
Right.
And we have to call our game soccer. I've only been in the States 33 years, and I'm still deeply
still
bitter about it.
Still
no, I'm not even a big soccer football fan, actually, to be honest. But it's still, you know, it still gets to me.
Cause for resentment.
Well, no, actually, you know, I have to admit, I got my citizenship about 4 months ago.
That's right. Congratulations. Yeah. I think.
Yeah. You know what? To be honest, I'm very happy about
good.
It.
Good.
I love this country. I know it's a wee bit topsy-turvy right now, understatement, but it's still, is incredible, and I'm so glad I'm here.
Great to hear. We love this country, too.
I'm giving it, I give thanks for that.
Yeah.
For sure.
There you go.
My family and I, so my wife, my 12-year-old Lilibet, Lily, and I, we drove over to Spokane on Thanksgiving to spend a few days with my wife's older sister who moved there a year or so ago, mm-hmm. And a large portion of her family. And surprisingly, it was lovely.
Did you drift into the Davenport Hotel?
No, but there we didn't have time for that. But yeah. I hear it's lovely. I know there was a big tree lighting ceremony.
That's right.
The next day, we weren't able to stay for that. But my son, actually, who's in a wheelchair, he's 23, Xander. He went out on the train. He can't sit in a car for mm-hmm. 5 or 6 hours. And giving thanks, it got there early. Mm-hmm. And he had a lovely trip. In fact, he came back and said he really loves the train. So, thanks to those people who are running that wonderful train service.
That train is wonderful.
It really is.
And it is known for oftentimes being off schedule.
Yes.
So it was very fortunate.
Yeah, well, it was off schedule, but it was early.
Oh, well, that's good.
Right. Yes. Right.
That's even rarer.
Yeah, it was, we only had one very heated political conversation, which I kind of relish. And when the patriarch of the family starts a sentence with, "I'm not racist, but..."
But.
You know, it's going to go really well.
Yeah, the key word
really,
is
really
but.
Well.
Oh, boy.
So,
And it was in that individual's home.
No, actually, no. It was not in his home, but they traveled from Utah or wherever they live. Nevada. That's it. Nevada.
Somewhere
one of those.
Somewhere in the West.
One of those places where the taxes are lower. The taxes are lower. I don't care about the whatever else is going on. The taxes are lower.
All right.
Okay, but you spend $9,000 a year in air conditioning. I get it. Yeah.
Got to have lower taxes if you're going to spend $9,000 a year in air conditioning.
Absolutely.
I guess.
Anyway, but it was a lovely week, Well,
that's good. Yeah, that the family discussions around the holiday tables can be interesting. I'm always... when I'm at a friend's house or a relative's house and they take a different political position, I go, I know it's your house. I'm in your home. But,
Yeah, I I don't. I think if you open your mouth and you say something offensive and dumb, I think you're fair
open
game.
Open season.
I think you're fair game.
Yep.
Yeah.
I agree.
So how about you, Craig? What did you do?
What did I do? I didn't do anything.
Oh, I know better than that.
No, I got... Lynette and I went down to California, down to the Bay Area last Thursday. We avoided all the craziness at the airport and came back last night. And everything was mellow on those days and right on time. And it was great. But we went down to visit my brother and... his family, his daughters, and their families, it was a great time. Unfortunately, our son and daughter, Nick and Kate, were going to come down. They were going to drive down from Ashland, which is actually a reasonable drive from the California border, basically down to Oakland. But they both, having just got back from Mexico City, seem to have come down with something that is lingering. Oh. So they. They weren't able to make it, which was a crying shame. But
yeah.
I think they're feeling better, slowly but surely. But when I was down there, I visited a whole bunch of old haunts. Drove around and went through the Haight-Ashbury and Golden Gate Park and Union Square. And San Francisco just looked like the hellhole it's been described. it was absolutely gorgeous. There, beautiful, beautiful day, beautiful people walking down along the wharf and the seawall. And we went, for the first time, we went to Fort Point, the fort under the Golden Gate Bridge. The bridge was modified in order to be able to preserve Fort Point, and they've turned it into a marvelous museum.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is. Have you been in there since it's turned into a museum by any chance?
I've spent a lot of time around that area.
Yeah.
My wife is from the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah. The not only is it historically a gorgeous, you know, Civil War or fort, but now they have world class exhibitions in the various rooms where the cannon are placed, and almost holographic in nature. It's just first class. Yeah.
I believe that's the area where that wonderful scene in Harold and Maude was filmed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that is.
Where he disappears down the street. Such a beautiful movie.
Yeah, that was fun. We went and visited, went by my old houses when I was a kid down in Los Altos and San Mateo, and we've run into people there out in front on occasion, you know. This time we didn't, but they were hiding in their houses on the floor wondering who has stopped out there in front of their house peering in. I thought maybe we better move along.
They might have thought you were ice.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's unlikely they thought I was ice, but yeah, right. You never know. I was driving an old BMW. Not mine, my brother's. But no, it was a great week. So, and here we are. Now we're moving on another holiday known as Christmas. Oh, you know, before I forget, I mentioned that we had a limited number of Brieflies here today. I should have mentioned the fact that the two fellow Brieflies that aren't here, Kevin Jones, had an eye appointment that just came up right at the same time as the Briefly today. And Amy just got back in town, and she was swamped, I think, with her job as the director of Household, Vashon Household. So at the last minute, she sent us a note and said, I can't get out from underneath this. So that happens. Two wonderful members of the Brieflies. Almost as wonderful as the two that are here.
We carry our weight.
That's right. Yeah. And we have some weight to carry. Yes, right.
Speak for yourself.
I was going to say, I resemble that remark.
All right. Come on. Hey, let's check in to see what hope and inspiration we can conjure up from today's day in history. In 1804, General Napoleon Bonaparte is crowned Emperor of the French at Notre Dame de Paris in a ceremony officiated by Pope Pius VII.
Wow.
I know. You don't have any insights on that, do you?
Well, you know, being English, I have some opinions of the French. And not only based on, you know, several thousand years of repeated invasions. But there is, you know... without wishing to offend any of the French people who live on Vashon, and if I do offend you, I don't care. I do, of course. I love your mopeds. How many Frenchmen does it take to defend Paris?
No one knows.
No one knows. It's never been done.
Ah, see, I was good. I picked that right out of the air.
You did well.
Yeah, ba-boom. Well.
You know, I joke about that, but... I always, when I tell that joke, I feel terrible because I think about the absolute incredible bravery of the French resistance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Well, which brings up a related subject. Your last name
is French.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Well, you know, I tell people I am actually English, Irish, French with a little bit of apparently Portuguese. I believe the story is that my family were French Huguenot, you know. Maybe escape the country because they didn't want their heads chopped off.
Right.
Because they controlled half. They controlled 95% of the wealth in the land.
Right.
Wait a minute. Is there any parallels going on now?
Yeah,
anyway,
say.
Bring back the guillotine. Anyway, so they you know, and then I think they became farmers, and which was a tradition on my father's side of the family. And but my mother's side of the family are Irish... you know, Irish Catholics.
Uh-huh.
And my great-grandfather on my mother's side was what we call Romani.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And so I think that's where the Portuguese element was.
Right. And that Mediterranean attitude.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'm English, Irish, French. So the way I describe it is the Irish hate the English. The English hate the French, and the French hate everybody.
So there you go.
So I'm deeply conflicted.
Don't be a hater.
Right? No, I'm not actually. I know. You know, I'm not at all. I, you know.
Well, do you have the Irish side coming out? That can
yes,
you
see that. Absolutely.
Well, continuing on with what happened today in history, in 1927, the first Model A Ford was sold for $385, and I looked this up, but the cheapest, the least expensive Ford in 2025 is the new Ford Maverick compact truck, which is an unfortunate name to bring back if anybody ever owned one of those Mavericks.
Oh, I don't know the old ones.
Yeah, the old ones are just pieces of you know what.
Well, I have to say, we've never bought a new vehicle, but we just, like 6 months ago, bought a Maverick because our old pickup just...
Oh, you bought the new Maverick.
New Maverick.
Oh, which is a wonderful
it's
car.
It's a fantastic car.
Yeah, it is.
I'm you know, it looks small, but it actually doesn't feel small when you're in it. It's a fantastic
no, it's
car.
No, it might even have been car of the year.
You know, I have a Honda Ridgeline. And,
yeah.
And I've been looking at those because my Ridgeline is pretty tall.
Mm.
And the older I get, the harder it gets to get into the darn
yeah, this
thing.
Thing is easy. I mean, it's great.
Right, it's fairly it's really, low. It's, isn't
I
it?
Mean, I have no complaints about it whatsoever. Yeah. It drives beautifully.
I've been looking at it.
Very comfortable. Time. Doesn't, yeah. You know, very solid. Right. I did a little math when I first got here when I read through these questions.
Yeah.
And in 1927, the average weekly wage was $20 to $21. Which meant that, you know, your average yearly wage was about $1,040.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you're looking about, you know, just under a third of your yearly wage would have cost you this car.
Right.
Well, that's,
so if you think about, I don't know what the average, you know, annual wage is for, you know, a fairly well-to-do middle-class American nowadays, or family.
90 to 100. Yeah.
Probably. So it's comparably about the same.
Wow.
Surprisingly.
Yeah.
And
surprisingly.
And I think a new Maverick's base price is $30,000, just about $30,000.
Yeah. Right.
So that's,
exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. So we guess we didn't mention that $30,000.
No, I forgot to mention.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, so hopefully now my math makes sense to
see. It does.
Yeah, otherwise, they're like, what is he talking about? Why is he talking about? Not what? Why?
Yes. I thought I'd fill in that void there for
why
a moment.
Why is he talking again?
And last but not least, the other thing that I wanted to mention that happened today in 2020, United States Attorney General Bill Barr. Mm-hmm. Said that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election, despite claims by President Donald Trump.
What, you mean he lied?
Well, he does say it over and over and over again.
If you say something enough, it becomes well, it's true.
Well, some people start believing it. You're right. Mm-hmm. December 2nd. Go ahead,
Let me
Bruce.
Break in and say it's interesting. If I recall, when Napoleon was crowned emperor, he took the crown away from the Pope.
As you remember or as you recall?
That's right. But he put it on himself rather than having the Pope do it.
Oh, yeah.
Which sort of, you know, sort of has echoes with what our current king is thinking about doing. So.
Well, did he do that with who was it? The Turks? Who gave him the Hungarians?
Oh, that's right. Yes,
gave him that crown?
Well, and the Chinese, you know.
I think it was the Koreans, actually.
That's right. It was the Koreans.
But crown. Napoleon had bigger hands, apparently.
That's right.
Yeah. It was only 3'6", but he had bigger hands than Donald Trump.
Doesn't everybody?
And his head wasn't quite as big either.
My goodness. December 2nd, by the way, if you didn't already know this, is National Bartender Day, National Mutt Day. And I love mutts because we've had our share, and they're all rescues and have been some of the most spectacular dogs. Our current dog is almost 15, and she is still running around happy as a mutt. It's also International Day for the Abolition of Slavery, which unfortunately still exists in many parts of the world.
I'm not racist, but...
There you go. That's right. Some of my best friends.
Yes.
I have a friend, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get right into our small talk guest here. Martin, thank you for joining us. This is, I think, your first... appearance on the Brown Briefly show.
It is, yes.
Yeah, I think you've walked in on a morning scramble or two and some other
yeah,
shows.
Yeah, I come in so Mr. Whitmore can ridicule me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's just amazing at that.
Yep, yep. And our listeners who may recognize your voice or one of your characters may not know your origin story. I mean, tell us a little bit about your background. You told us a little bit about your nationalities.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about how you ended up here on Vashon and what you did before you got here.
Sure. Okay. I was born in a little town called Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-I-G-H, in Suffolk in England, which is kind of the breadbasket area of England. If you look at England, it's sometimes described as an old man sitting on a toilet. Mm-hmm. And where I'm from is right in the butt crack. how appropriate.
Yeah.
And the nearest largest town is called Ipswich. It's about 10 miles away.
Oh, yeah.
And so, let's see, it's a very small medieval town, lots of Tudor buildings, very beautiful, 9th century church, a Viking king of England, or at least East Anglia, is buried there, King Guthrum, who fought the Christians for quite a long time. And won many, mostly won.
Mostly won.
Until, of course, near the end when he was actually, caught and then turned to Christianity.
Oh, of course.
Which had nothing to do with the fact that they were going to cut his head off. Yeah, nothing
sheer
at
coincidence.
All. Nothing. Sheer coincidence. Anyway,
chopping
so
conversion, right?
That's right. Yes, he lived out his final days in our little village. It's beautiful. Nothing to do. Nowhere to go. When I was young, there was 13 pubs and nothing else. Just lots of fighting and drinking and I grew up on a council estate. My mum and dad had this old motorcycle and sidecar. We didn't have a car. And so it's just kind of what got me into motorcycling. Mm-hmm. And I still have that motorcycle here on the island. And then, because there really isn't much else to do, I was really attracted to the arts. I had a kind of skill from an early age for drawing and illustration. So I went to art college. But also my love of kind of acting and drama and music kind of came out, mostly thanks to my incredible drama teacher, who I was pretty shy and really introverted as a kid. And my dad was a very difficult man. My mother was a very nervous woman. So there wasn't like a lot of household example to kind of...
Amazing how one person could make that difference.
Yes.
A life.
Yeah, in an era now where we're trying to cut back on arts and those things in school, it's so sad. But yes, he was an amazing guy, and he just gave me this, permission to be a lot more than I thought I could be. And so I started doing school plays, and some were musicals, and then I started my first band when I was 15. We were terrible. And
what was the name of it? Do you remember?
Not going to tell you. Actually, All the Rage.
Not bad.
All the Rage?
All the Rage.
Oh,
yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Why? And our first show was a fundraiser for the Labour Party.
All right.
Oh, wow.
When I was 15, 16. Yeah, there we go. Damn lefties. Anyway. So yes, that kind of got me into music. I have no formal training. It's not like, I basically grew up in an environment where, as much as I really wanted to pursue a musical education or a drama education, I couldn't do that. I had to go get a job. So when I went to art college for 2 years, and then I got a job as an illustrator, graphic designer, and did that for a few years. But that didn't work for me. And then I worked for a company for about 4 or 5 years. And when they had to kind of downsize, they had a meeting and said, hey, you know, we want some voluntary redundant. And they didn't even finish the word redundancy, and my hand was in the air. And I was out. And I had enough I got enough money to buy an 8-track recorder, a few more microphones, and a little mixer. And, you know, upgraded my little setup. And I just, for a year or two, I just recorded every band that I would let me record them for free or for Indian food. And then, because that's how you value things.
That's right.
That's how you value things. Now, I'll do it for 2 chicken kormas, some Peshwari naan, and some rice.
And I'm going to hold out for you.
That's right. Yes. I don't need any rice pudding. Anyway. But, you know, that led to some, and I had a band, you know, which was doing quite well in that part of England. I got hooked up with a small management company and someone who owned a Dodge milk wagon that they had converted into a little tour bus. But they put the seat mounts backwards, so their seats were leaning slightly forwards rather than backwards. That was a comfortable ride, I can tell you. Never heard a word of complaint from the bands I was driving for.
Yeah.
You're driving for 12 to 14 hours in Europe from one show to the next. You know, you play a show, you get back to your hotel room at 2 in the morning, you get up at 6, and then you drive for 12 hours, and then hopefully you're going to make the sound check by 6-ish.
Yeah,
well. It was really fun. Really fun. It was actually fun. But I started driving for some American bands and occasionally did a little sound here or there. And then that led me to tour with a band called the Screaming Trees, who are from Ellensburg, who were one of the first bands in the Northwest to get a major label record deal. And they were already regionally quite successful and fairly well known nationally on the indie scene. And they gave Nirvana their first shows and let Nirvana open up for them and gave Nirvana a lot of breaks. So in return, when Nirvana started to really explode, they returned the favor. And suddenly, you know, Screaming Trees were doing huge shows to 80 and 150,000 people. Mm. And that's when I joined them, and it was mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make it across the pond?
On an airplane. I don't know if you've... They're amazing things. You should try one day.
We have, without...
I know you
success.
Have one, right? You have one, right? Yeah, I know you, fancy fellow. No, actually what it was, they actually... I had no intention of moving here. But I toured with them for 6 weeks in the summer of 92. And I just got a phone call like a few weeks later. And they said, hey, we're coming back to the UK and we're doing Reading Festival with Nirvana. And we're playing a few UK shows. Would you help us with the gear? Come pick us up and do monitors, which is stage sound. Not sound that you hear in the room, but it's the sound for the band, you know, on stage. And I said, sure. And I didn't know how to do that. So I called my friend and said, hey, how the hell do you do monitors? So I went to his house and he showed me a few things. And I, like, I got it. And then I went and did sound for these guys, in front of 80,000 people.
They could hear themselves.
Apparently.
You know how it is when the...
Oh, when you come... Oh, I know. I know how it is, yes. So that's what I basically... and then... So I did that little short stint thinking I would never hear from them again. And a couple of weeks later, they said, hey, we've got this long U.S. tour coming up with this band Alice in Chains that's breaking out of Seattle. We're opening up. Would you come over? And I said, you bet. And then two weeks later...
When was that?
That I arrived on September 22nd, 1992.
Okay. Wow.
And so I toured with them, and it was an incredible experience. I made lots of friends. I got offered work that I know I couldn't have got in England. Because that's one of the wonderful things about America. And I know it's not... I'm generalizing here. But generally in America, because of part of its, you know, historic... the way it's grown, the class system over here is quite different, right? And one of the reasons why it keeps growing is that people make wise decisions. If they're surrounded by people that do good work and are professional, it helps them. It's not based on class, but more based on what can you do?
Performance.
What are you like as a person? What are your skills? Are you good to be with? Are you going to help me and raise myself up while you raise yourself up?
You're saying that over there you were...
It's very much classes. You are very much locked in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's got a little better, but it's still very much a class system where, it's more about your background.
Well, I find that interesting. I mean, the Beatles, were always... They were kind of, what am I trying to say? Blue shirt.
Yeah, working class.
Yeah, working class guys, you know what I mean? Yep. And boy, they took off.
Very working class, yes.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, though, you know. But you know, it's you know, I think the music industry is slightly different, but yeah, still not. Yeah. Because I remember, you know, I'd been in the States for, you know, 5 or 6 years. I did a record for a band that they signed a huge record deal. I went back to England and mixed them live on BBC Radio London. Mm-hmm. A room that I could never, ever, ever get into with my own band. They would never even look at me. Yeah. And I remember being in there, and the DJ, seriously, it's like this. Hello. Yeah, here I am. Yes, we will have a Rob so-and-so. And next up, we have Super Deluxe, a great pop band from Seattle. And he turns to me and he goes, oh, hello, how are you? And I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, wow.
And
wow.
He's just basically pretending to be all like street. Yeah. But he's really, he probably went to Eton, and daddy got him the job.
Wow.
You see?
Wow.
And to me, I'm just like, thank goodness I moved to the States.
Yeah.
So anyway, should I move on?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's how I got to the States.
Right.
And then, you know, I came here with $300 and a few microphones, and then I, you know, kept working, lived on top ramen noodles and cream cheese and bagels and just started picking up work. Touring, a little bit of recording here and there. I would go out and tour manage bands and mix their live audio. And then I had that record I just mentioned. It did really quite well. And I decided, well, I'd met a lot of older folks that had been touring for 20 years or so. And they were deaf and miserable and, you know, doing drugs and cheating on their partners and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I really don't want to be that. So the drugs bit, yeah, okay, I'm fine with. No, I'm not. Anyway, so I decided I didn't want to do that, so I kind of focused more on the recording. And I found a lot of those guys just wish they were record producers. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wait a minute, I already have a career that's kind of going that way. Mm-hmm. So I just kept recording and recording and recording and occasionally go out on the road with the band to do some shows here or to mix some shows or whatever. But it led to me being able to build my first studio in Seattle and then also work at other studios too. And then I worked with some artists that did quite well, and I was able to continue working. And that's how, you know, I had a studio in Wallingford for about 20 years. And then I closed that down in 2014, yes, and moved here to Vashon.
Hmm. Why?
Because I love being in a place where no one needs to use their turn signals. I love living on a place where people on their phone smoking and vaping are crossing the median and heading at you at 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love being able to cross the street and nearly get run over by old people whose dogs are on their laps.
Yeah.
No, I, you know.
Use your blinker.
Yes. I'm going to make some t-shirts that say turn signals, not on this island.
That's right.
Yeah. Or
the island. Or the four-way stop.
You know, yes,
the
exactly.
Four-way stops,
it's beautiful.
Fun.
It's beautiful. Yeah. No, every, I'm joking, but, you know, every little town, village, whatever has its idiosyncrasies. And, you know, ours are usually not that bad, really. I moved here because I knew that there was orgies on the island. That's what I heard. Craig, you know, the swinging apparently is just superb.
Yeah, right.
And one day I will, I'll say yes,
quiet,
okay?
Quiet.
One day I'll say yes, okay, Craig? No, that's not it. No, that's not it. Basically, you know, I was getting pretty tired of the city. My cost of living at the studio had gone up, you know, of just paying the rates. Paying the rent, paying everything, had gone up so high that I had to work so much just to keep the doors open before I could pay myself a penny. Mm-hmm. And I was utterly exhausted. I'd had some bad health for about 12 years, and just mostly just through overwork and stress. And I just knew I needed time for change. And my family, you know, they kind of felt the same way, although I bought it on pretty quick. I mean, I didn't give them a lot of time to really question it. I just, I can't survive like this. My wife has a very successful flower shop in Greenwood, so she still commutes like, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, and she's amazing. I don't know how she does it, but I commuted for a year while I was shutting the other one down and building the new studio at my house, and that was enough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just the community here is amazing. We've made amazing friends, the arts community, the vintage motorcycle community. I knew people out here that, you know, were part of all those things. And we thought we would have a quiet life here that would be much quieter than the city. But what I love about it is our social life is so much more vibrant than it was even in Seattle.
Right.
So, you know, we're very grateful. Okay. And plus, we have a lovely place. We have a lot more land and space than we did in Seattle. I probably wouldn't be the case now. I don't think we could afford to move here now. We came here, I think, at the last possible moment that we could have.
That's a common refrain.
I think it is. I think it is. You know, but that's what brought me here, and I don't regret it.
You know, one of the things I'm fascinated by. I have a nephew who is all self-taught. He's an IT guy. He's now a VP of a big company.
Right.
You know, IT thing. All self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really that the people who come up that way have such a greater understanding, I think, of everything that's involved in getting there. And so I'm fascinated by your producer, engineer, mixer, musician, singer, songwriter, all of those things. Tell us about how all of those come together for you.
I'll try and do that quickly.
Yeah.
Well, really, I've learned these things out of necessity. There was a couple of recording schools in England. I couldn't afford to go to one. And it's not like something you could, where I grew up, you couldn't just like say, mommy, daddy, I want to go and learn to be this. And like, okay, darling, go. It was like, you couldn't do it. You had to. So it was just out of necessity. I learned to record because there was nowhere, no one else around. There was nowhere else really to go in my little area of England that would record me. I couldn't afford to record. So I did paper rounds and, you know, jobs and stuff and bought two cassette players that would record, and I bounce back, that kind of thing, you know. So I get asked these questions a lot to kind of define these. I'll go through these things here pretty quick. I won't do them in the order that you've given them because I'll do them. So, you know, I learned to record because I started to make music.
Right.
I don't know if you describe it that, but I you know, I wanted to express myself and make music at the time. So I just learned to record, or engineer, as we say. So those two skills kind of, if you're in that environment, they kind of go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. As far as producing is, and the singer-songwriter thing, well, you know, I wrote my own songs. I sang my own songs, unfortunately, for those that were listening. and, you know, and through those three things, you know, the recording, the being a musician, singer-songwriter, I picked up unknowingly what are producer skills, which are, you know, skills of arranging, skills of, you know, songwriting, and figuring out how to deliver a song in a way that people would receive it in a good way and not turn it off halfway through or even in the first 5 seconds. And then the mixing side of it is kind of an extension of that. And now in the industry, there is people who do, you know, discrete things there. I'm a mixer, you know, I'm a producer only. And sometimes those people are producers because they're musicologists. They have the right language. They know how to work with musicians and kind of vocalize things, explain things so that they can help get their music out to the wider world in a way that the people will receive it. Mm-hmm. And some people are just engineers. They're not musical. They're technical people. I'd like to think of myself as someone that kind of hopefully is all of those things. But, you know, as far as producing is concerned, really it's kind of like the job of director of a movie. Mm-hmm. And not every director works the same way. Not every director does the same, approaches every movie with the same philosophy or actions. Mm-hmm. So my job as a producer is just to help an artist, whether it be a solo artist or a band or a songwriter, make the absolute best record they can in the time and budget. And sometimes that means just if the band and the artist is very well developed and their songs are great, it's just a matter of capturing it and making it sound, the sounds are right, they carry the songs, they're appropriate for that kind of music. Sometimes, though, it's the full extreme. I'm helping people write their songs. I'm singing on their record. I'm writing lyrics with them. I'm playing instruments. So it can go like the full gamut there. You know, I'm, you know, programming drums, playing percussion, playing keyboards, you know, doing a lot of that thing. So it can be, you know, as simple as I want to make sure I capture this, or it can be as deep as we're starting from the ground up and I'm going to kind of look at every single element of a record to make sure it delivers what the artist wants.
And it would seem to me that having that technical background gives you a leg up.
It's essential. And yeah, the musical one too. Exactly. It's essential. Yeah.
Because then you understand what is missing or what needs to be mixed.
Right. When I was coming up as an engineer, I worked with some very, very, very successful producers who made millions of dollars but didn't have a single musical bone in their body.
Oh.
Right? It was like, okay, wow, this guy's got nothing. But he's a good technical producer. He makes everything sound a certain way. And then you work with other people who don't even know how to touch a mixing console, but they're incredibly musical, and they know how to capture one, like Rick Rubin, right? Not musical. Can't play an instrument, doesn't really know how to use any equipment, but he knows when something works musically, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got other people on the other end of the spectrum who, you know, they can write string arrangements and play tons of instruments. So it just varies, you know.
Yeah.
You've got people like Herb Alpert who
incredible
make a zillion dollars changing from playing a trumpet to
running a record label.
That's right.
Wrote some amazing music, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Quincy Jones, too. I mean, wow. Yeah.
Let me ask you, I mean, you've been doing this 30-plus years, right?
Yeah, about 40.
Yeah, about 40 years. Yeah, so how has the technology changed in terms of how has it affected what you do? And then a follow-up to that is, how is AI affecting you?
Okay, well,
two parts.
Sure. As far as the technology is concerned, I think one of the things that's been really amazing about the music industry is it's always just grasp technology, new tech, you know, changes in technology. And that sometimes takes a few years to get into the, you know, the hands of, you know, kind of people who aren't so much professionals.
Mm-hmm.
I love the, you know, the newer technology that has democratized the recording industry. It used to be almost cost prohibitive to get into recording. You had to have a lot of money or live, you know, basically you had to live a very, very, very meager, bare means so you could afford equipment and a space. Now, you know, most kids inherit a laptop from their parents and that's got software on it that's like 100 times more powerful than anything we had in the 80s or early 90s.
Right. Wow.
So that's good. Same time, that means that maybe there's a lot of people who, if the hurdles were a little taller, they would have gone in different directions. And they wouldn't be making really awful, insipid music.
Right.
But hey, you know, that's their choice, you know, and that's great though. But there's just a lot more stuff we have to sift through before we find the gold.
Right.
But that's just part of the way things. But I do love the changing technology. What I'm grateful for is that I have the experience of working in the analog world, so I know how to work on tape, 2-inch tape. I know how to edit it. I know how to bias a tape machine. I know how to fix things. I know how to wire cables, solder. And, you know, I also know what that technology sounds like, so I'm more able to use the digital world to get that sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still work with analog gear and digital gear. I love what the digital world it enables me to do. I can do fine, very, very fine tuning things that I've always wished I could do, and now I can do those things.
Mm-hmm.
And the wonderful thing about audio is it's kind of like, I think about it as like your vision.
Mm-hmm.
The more colors you look at and you figure out their subtleties and their percentages of you know, cyan, magenta, or whatever, the more colors you're able to see and the more subtlety you're able to see. And that's the wonderful thing about audio is and music is the more you learn, the more it allows you to learn. As long as you don't go deaf.
Yeah. So is that sort of, do you see that as part of that turn back to vinyl and to analog,
you know,
kind of recordings versus digital?
I think people are turning back to vinyl, mm-hmm. and now CD again, actually, which is cool. Kids are buying CDs. Is the understanding of the value, at least the value of having something material, mm-hmm. not necessarily paying for music, because mm-hmm. people still don't want to pay for music now. It's 15 years out of the bag. It's too late. But having something material that you can kind of romanticize a little bit, mm-hmm. which is what we did as kids, mm-hmm. reading every liner note on mm-hmm. every record over and over and over again while you're listening to the record or looking at the art. It brings something more to the music instead of having thousands of songs on this device that you haven't paid any money for. There's a sense of attachment and ownership. Mm. The whole argument, vinyl sounds warmer, better, that's actually kind of crap. But vinyl sounds more pleasing to us because of the limited bandwidth that it has, right? We as animals, we love the mid-range, right? That's where our hearing is centered. It's centered at 1 kilohertz. So, you know, vinyl has its center at 1 kilohertz. We love that, right? It has limited bandwidth. It rolls off at mm-hmm. the top end, like 10, 12 kilohertz. It rolls off at the bottom end, you know, at 100 hertz generally. And it's distorted. And we love distortion mm-hmm. as human beings. And we love mostly even harmonics because it's more pleasant. But we also love odd harmonics because it's exciting and naughty. And so that's why vinyl kind of sounds better to us. Now, if you put things on a scope, you know, CDs sound seriously better than vinyl. They have better dynamic range, frequency response, everything. You know, but we love that, you know, we love that gushy, noisy, dirty, scratchy, crackly thing.
That's where our hearing ends up as we get older.
That's right.
Middle range.
That's right.
It's very visceral.
Yeah, it is.
You know, one of the things I was going to comment on, I'm a pilot. I started flying more than 60 years ago, and the technology is just amazing.
Yeah.
You can imagine the change. Yeah. And I learned all the old stuff, you know, with a pencil and a protractor. And mm-hmm. and now I appreciate that technology change so much more. But I have such a deeper understanding, I think, of all of that process than the new kids coming along who have only learned the magic that happens now.
Yes, right. So they take it for granted. And
exactly.
they're using digital versions of things that they don't even understand how they work
exactly.
or why they work.
Exactly.
Their application.
Yeah. They're not stuffing newspapers and amplifiers to get interesting
exactly.
sounds.
Okay, yes. You know, although the thing is, what I have found is that it is leading people to go back to some of the older equipment, which is great. I mean, look, I have some equipment now that because of the digital world, the digital replications of it are so much more valuable now because people want to get their hands on the real thing. They've been romanticized, you know. So it's interesting.
All right, so I have a question. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I have never seen Bowie Rex.
Yeah, so I haven't either.
So I don't have a clue. So
okay.
Tell us about Bowie Rex.
Well, I'll do that as quick as I can. Okay. So... I've always been a huge David Bowie fan. He's been there like basically every decade of my life, you know, from when I was little. And so I've always loved his music. And then a few years ago, just for fun, I started a bit of a kind of a thing called Bowie Idol, which is I did a kind of a piss take of Billy Idol and David Bowie, and I would kind of mash the two together and go off and come on and just kind of playing around with it and with my wifey and some friends, and it was a lot of fun and the reaction was good, and that kind of collapsed, and I don't need to tell you why, but it kind of collapsed. Just became more work than joy. But the musical side of it I loved. And then so I sang with a friend of mine who was in a band called the Presidents of the United States of America. He had a band that comes to the island. They're called the Special Riders, and they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I've produced a few records for the Presidents, and so we knew each other through that. And when he came to the island, he would just ask me to get up and sing a Bowie song here or there. And it went very well. And I thought, okay. And then I reached out to him and said, look, hey, I've got this concept for a band, which is kind of a a mashup with David Bowie and T-Rex, you know, Mark Bolan. And then I'd like to do the stuff from the, you know, late 60s through the 70s and maybe some other stuff when it felt, you know, right. But I'd like to kind of have it have, create this character called Bowie Rex and have a band called his Boogie Army, where we just kind of do all of our favorite songs, David Bowie, T-Rex, The Kinks, The Cars, Joy Division, Prince, Blondie, The Faces, you know, Sweet, all these bands that we kind of grew up with that we love. So he said, yeah. So then I started reaching out to other people and said, like, hey, Dave's on board. Are you interested? And my favorite Seattle drummer, and sorry, other favorite Seattle drummers. But no, just a guy I'd worked with a lot who plays in Duff McKagan's band and other, I've recorded with him a lot. He said yes. And then, so I put this band together and, just from the get go, it just felt amazing. So we just, you know, I've got my persona. I put the 6-inch heels on and dress up. So our whole thing is to take camo and demachofy it. So I put all the glitter and glam and the makeup and the hair and the whatever and the painted nails and
the boa,
the bows and stuff and the heels, and then we put glamo with it. And our whole thing is stock up on your glamo.
Oh, that's so awesome!
And so with the Boogie Army theme, and we put on a dance party, and we, you know, we just play for a couple of hours, and have our slogan is "Dance your knockers off."
And the fans love it.
It's been amazing.
Much feedback to you, the way they love.
It is amazing. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about it is, you know, going to see a lot of bands and working with a lot of bands, a lot of people look miserable when they're playing, when they're doing shows. Yeah. They look like they're doing community service.
Especially the bass players.
The bass players. And so that's because they don't know which string to play next. So our whole thing is, like, you know, we're so grateful for the opportunity, and we're just going to, like, try and spit out as much joy and inclusiveness as we can. And we're playing New Year's Eve again. And
that's what I was going to say. Third, the next time you do that,
yeah,
is?
Yeah, it's going to be New Year's Eve. Third year in a row.
Oh, wow.
Probably the last time for a bit, because we don't want to overstay our welcome.
Oh, I don't know.
If they miss us next year, maybe we'll come back the year after.
Well, then they'll be clamoring for next year.
Well, we'll
year,
see. Right? Or they'll be like, well, thank God they're not playing.
Well, you got a demographic on the island that doesn't remember the prior year.
Oh, there's the prior day.
So you're going to be where?
At O Space on New Year's Eve. And then...
tickets are still for sale?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Do I have time to mention that I'm also putting a show next Saturday?
Absolutely. At Snap?
At Snapdragon, yeah. The Black Cat Cabaret with Ink. Wonderful, beautiful, lovely Cat Eggleston. I'm putting on a show called Masters of Folk.
Oh, yeah.
And it's next Saturday at Snapdragon. Our doors are at 6. It starts at 7. It's in the round with a Seattle singer-songwriter called Barton Carroll, who I've worked with for 25 years and made a bunch of records with him. He took a break for a while, and I encouraged him to kind of start writing again, and he's just started writing again. I hooked them up. They heard each other's music. They love each other. And it's in the round. They're going to do a song each and switch off, take a short break, and then do the same thing again. So two sets. And they are both really smart, beautiful, authentic songwriters and really funny people.
All right.
Once again, that's Saturday?
This Saturday, December 6th. Okay. Doors at 6, show at 7, $20.
Perfect.
So you've got that at Snap, and then you've got Bowie Rex on the
New
Year's Eve, and then you probably have some other things, but we'll wait on those.
Sure. Some other have me come back. And
surprises.
And I'll speak for hours.
Thank
and
you.
And hold you up again.
Martin, thank you very, very much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, yeah. No.
I really appreciate it.
Truman, next week is the Truman Show. What do you think you might be having us discuss?
Well, I got a couple of things going. But we're going to have Marie Bradley come in and tell us a little bit give us an update on the Inspiration Point project that she's been working on. But that'll be fairly short. But then we're going to go, I want to explore leadership. With all the things that we've got going on, you know, following illegal orders and all of that, I really want to explore this whole concept of leadership. What's that about? Followership. What do you have to do? How do you have to suborn yourself to to work with somebody who's a leader? And who do you look for a leader? And then what do you do? What things do you do to make yourself a leader? So I kind of want to address that.
Sounds like a good show.
Should be fun.
I think it will be. So I want to thank Martin Fevrier with the French last name, Truman, Bruce, and myself. We thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next week on the Brown Briefly Show.